Food for Faith, and this is a little bit different. It's not some of the usual Food for Faith recordings that you're used to, but it's a one-off. It might grow into something more than that, but it's a one-off reflection that was prompted in a conversation I had last week after the Pope's encyclical, Magnifica Humanitas, Magnificent Humanity. I'm still loving saying it in English, Magnificent Humanity. But a lot of people read it, and many people began their conversations by saying, I can't believe I'm agreeing with the Pope, but, and then they would say something that they got from the encyclical. What the Pope's really, I think, hoping that we will do is engage in theology. So the question arises, what is theology? And so I've gathered together three people to chat about this, three theologians, even Rocio, Merv, and Tracy. Could each of you take a moment to introduce yourselves? And I've said to them, don't be humble in your introduction, just state what it is you do, your claim to fame, and why you think you might offer something to this conversation on what is theology.
So hello, my name is Rocio Figueroa. I am a Peruvian theologian, and I work at the Catholic Theological College in Auckland. I am also a researcher, and I'm quite into my focus on research is about ecclesiology, the response of the church regarding abuse, spiritual abuse, sexual abuse. I am very interested also in the topic of women within the church. So those are my main important focus on my research.
Great, Rocio. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. Lovely. Happy to be here.
Hi, I'm Merv Duffy, Catholic priest. Ex-theology lecturer. I did 20-odd years at the Catholic Theological College in Auckland and its precursor institutions. So lectured in dogmatic theology, or systematic theology, as is it's sometimes more nicely described. Interested in early missionaries in the Pacific, interested in faith, in art, interested in popular expressions of the faith, and how those capture the religious truths often better than sermons of learned bishops.
Indeed. Well, and you've used some big words there, Merv, dogmatic theology and systematic theology. So we're going to have to unpack those in the next half hour or so. I hope you're ready to.
Oh, you'll recognize dogmatic when you hear me.
I've often heard people say that, Merv. Tracy, now you're not on our shores, but as we say, across the ditch.
Yes, so hello, everyone. I'm Tracy McEwen. I'm a theologian and a sociologist of religion. So I'm a feminist theologian. So that means I bring a feminist lens to theology. Like, I guess Merv's dogmatic and systematic. I'm feminist in my approach to theology. And what my work tends to do is bring a critical interdisciplinary lens or approach to power and authority in the Catholic Church, with particular attention to the experiences and perspectives of women. So at the moment, I'm a research fellow at the University of Newcastle across in Australia, and I'm also I'm the inaugural Australian Catholic University Australian Catholic History Fellow, and that means I'm writing a book on historical experiences of harm among Catholic women religious or nuns. And I guess a plug for my book, I've just published a book in theology called Women in the Catholic Church, Negotiating Identity and Agency, and it's available open access. So it explores some of the questions that we're going to be talking about today in terms of what's theology and what does it mean to have a religious identity, and can we do theology if we're not attending church and praying regularly?
And maybe we can add to that for all of us. Can we do theology if we've never studied theology? And that's really perhaps part of the motivation for this, because my sense is that many people in parishes have theological minds and hearts and don't know that they have. So maybe we can encourage them. So, so you're all theologians. So what is theology?
So I would like to begin with the etymology of the word, because that can help us to understand what is theology. Theology comes from the Greek theo, means God, and logos means words or discourse. So etymologically, really, it's actually God's words, God's talk. But it's quite interesting because usually when we translate it into English or also Spanish, teología or theology, it's like it seems like it's the study of God. But I always struggle a little bit with that study of God, the preposition of. I struggle a little bit because it looks like we can put God as an object of our study. Like we can be detached from that God and we can put God as we are the subject, the who study, and God is the object of our study. And I think that's really quite wrong, because God cannot be an object of as any other study. Actually, God is the subject, and we are not the subject of this. It's about actually a relation more than a detached study of an object like any other science. So that's I think, gives us a hint of what we are talking about.
So when I think about the word theology, I think of, like you did, just dissected, Rossi, that really when we talk about theology, we're talking about God talk or thinking about God. So I would say that we do theology every time we're thinking about God talking about God. And that might mean that we're out in like the bush or, you know, out in nature and we're looking at a sunset and we feel that awe of that beauty and of God's creation. Or it might be like I did during the week and I stopped and I looked up through the trees and saw the beauty of that creation and thought, God's really here with me. I think where like the confusion lies and where we sometimes get caught up is that in Catholicism and in other Christian traditions or, you know, non-Christian traditions, we have this kind of institutional belief and practice where we can sometimes get confused with prioritizing a hierarchical nature of, you know, what is and what isn't God and what is and isn't religious practice. And I think that sometimes confuses and makes theology bigger or more technical or more scientific than it actually is.
I'll agree with that very much, because basically human beings think about things. If I dropped a brick on John, John would immediately think, I've been attacked. He'd think, this is an assault. This is, so there's a sensation being hit with a brick, but there's immediately interpretation. Humans interpret things. Now, we believe that God is at work. So the initiative is with God. God creates. God reveals. God shows God's self in all sorts of ways. In that sunset, in the scriptures, in the life of the church, in my life, in every human life, in encounters of love, in encounters of hate, God is present. So that's God acting. Again, God talking. Humans immediately interpret the experience of God talking, because every conversation has a speaker and a listener, and there's no communication if there's not listening. You know, I've had lectures, there are absolutely wonderful lectures, but the students completely haven't got it.
Okay.
There's something false about that statement.
So it's, if God is the communicator and the initiator, the chief protagonist, is a problem that every person, every community is hearing through their own imperfect lens, ears, audio? So,
absolutely.
What other ears do you have?
Well, is this problematic or is it just part of the reality?
Well, it's part of the reality, and that's why we always say that theology is always contextual. We cannot avoid the fact that we are situated. So when we think through our lenses, we think through our culture, our history, our life, our experiences. And I think that also the fact that we are thinking about something that is much bigger than us, that is infinite. So it's always, it's a mystery. We are not, and that's why I say that it's not an object, like when I study a rock, like the minerals, that I can have an entire knowledge about the rock. We are here in front of the mystery of something that is superior, and that our reason, our heart is always limited because it's human. So I like that philosopher Gabriel Marcel when he says that we are between, we have a problem to solve or a mystery in front of us. And in the case of theology, we are in front of the mystery. So our knowledge is always limited. It's always depending on our way of seeing. And that is why we have to be very humble at the same time.
So, Merv, you're nodding a bit there. Rossio's continued what you were saying, yes?
Yes, and multiple lenses. I'm going to suggest that not all lenses are equally good. Some lenses can be foggy. Some lenses can distort.
I'm wondering about that. Like I'm not quite sure about. I understand the need to listen and to hear what's being saying, but God is sometimes there in the silence, and sometimes people don't think they're doing theology because they're not quite hearing like what they're meant to hear, or they've got foggy glasses on, and they're thinking this isn't what I'm meant to be hearing, or this isn't. I think we've got to remember God is also there in the silence, and sometimes we won't hear and we won't see, and that absence is important as well.
And in that regard, Tracy, that's quite good, because I think there is the apophatic dimension of theology. So theology, apophatic means actually the negation of, and the mystics always remember us that to know in God, you need the cataphatic, which is what you can say about God, but also the apophatic, what you cannot say.
Okay, and those two words there, Rocio, apophatic and cataphatic.
Yeah.
Sorry. Apophatic meaning mystery, more
that you can know God through negation.
And no statements. God is not in one place.
God is not an angel. God is not, but through silence also. Through the silence that Tracy, and actually the apophatic theology has been the typical way of doing theology of the mystics, that in which silence the mystery appears, the mystery opens us, and we do not hear, but it's an encounter through that silence, through that space that we create, that we are open to.
Okay, so Merv, you made a comment, God is not in one place, and this is a bit, I think people need to hear this, because people might often think that the church has communicated, this is the one place where God is. Not true.
Not true. And to make a true statement about God, our best true statements are not statements, are negations. So when we say God is infinite, we're saying God is not finite. God is not limited.
It's apophatic.
And that is apophatic. If I try and say something positive, even a statement like God is good, I understand good from good food, good friends, good conversation, but the goodness of God is not like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Any positive statement is always too weak to, it can't bear the weight of an infinite God. And so this is Rocio's mystery. and Tracy's silence. God doesn't sort of write across the sky, go to church. If he did, we all obeyed. We'd have to work out which church, but never mind. why doesn't God do that? Why doesn't he, get rid of all the atheists instantly? Just a few well-placed lightning bolts, and I could make recommendations for targets. But God has this weird respect for human freedom.
I'm going to pull you up there, Merv, because you just referred to God as he. And I think that's in the catechism says, God is neither male nor female. He is God. And so the pronoun he often comes out. But, as a feminist scholar, I don't actually use he or she. I don't think God is this person up in heaven operating traffic, and I don't think that's what you're inferring either, Merv. But in the study on which my book's based, I asked the women in the study, who is God for you? And for me, that's doing theology, who is God for you? And one of the women said to me that she didn't really have a sense of God until she was in the tsunami, the one that came through Thailand. And she said she was in this moment where, and she'd been struggling, actively struggling, with who God was for her and the Catholic faith. And she was in this moment where all the waters rushing towards her, she got caught on a fence. And in that moment, there was this presence. She said it was like an energy force, like this presence there with her in that moment. And she said to me, I've been struggling and grappling with that ever since. Was that God, that was there with me in that moment? And what does that mean for me moving forward? So I think if we want to start doing theology, we can start to ask ourselves, who is God for us? And that's that can be kind of a starting point for thinking about theology and God in our lives.
I wonder if we're helped by knowing a lot there, Tracy, who exactly, as you ask, who is God for us? Because the problem is God is something or someone for us. But if we don't know who God is for us, it becomes problematic. So when we are, because we need to be aware of our own lens. Merv, you're ready to go there.
Yeah. If we decide exactly who God is for us, that's also problematic. if you decide I have got God sussed, he fits into he, there you go. Same pronoun being thrown around. If God fits into my mind, then that is not God. If you claim, Augustine said, if you claim to have understood God, it is not God you have understood.
That's great. So the lens through which I see a lot of this is working one-on-one mostly with people, spiritual direction, and I find that people begin and they come in and they've got a pretty good idea of who God is, but it doesn't fit in their experience, or it's inadequate with the complex reality of their lives. So their process of spiritual and therefore human, or human and therefore spiritual growth, is to become much less clear. So the moment they begin to say God is like, we can't even get this out, God's not like that. No, so God is maybe like this.
And I think that's a progress in one way in our own journey. When at least I felt before I felt that, I knew who God was, no? And now actually I feel that I have more doubt, but more, not clarity, more foggy. But I feel in one way embraced in that not knowing, and I feel at peace, and I feel that I'm in the right path. Because I think that And in one way, I think faith is more darkness than light in this journey. And it's not about ideas. And I think sometimes we have thought that theology or thinking about God is having the good ideas or the clear ideas. But it is a relationship. You cannot define what is love. What do you feel for someone or why you love someone? You cannot explain it. I cannot explain why I love my husband. I love him immensely and I cannot explain why. And I think if I begin to explain with characteristics why, it will be restricted and reduced because I think actually that theology means that relationship with God. And I think in that regard, the feminist theologians have done a big contribution because they said it's not talking about God. It's talking, Elizabeth Johnson said, it's talking with God. So it is about a relationship that you cannot explain very well with ideas, but it embraces your heart, your intuition, your feelings, your mind, all your being.
I like that word grappling because I think you're kind of trying to touch something that's not tangible. And I think what you were saying, Merv, was if it is tangible, you know, is it really?
No, it's an idol.
And I look to sometimes, you know, there and when we do have something kind of tangible, and I've been thinking and wondering about this last week, you know, we've got the Eucharistic Congress coming to Sydney, and I've been thinking about that presence of God in the Eucharist and how that might be limiting our understanding of what God is amongst us. Because I see God, like this is my way of doing theology, I see God in everybody. I see God in nature. I see God all around me. You know, it's this mystery, this all-encompassing mystery. But is it when it's reduced to one thing, is that problematic? I guess I'm putting that like to the group.
Perhaps this is the reason that the first commandment is the first commandment. You know, you shall have no other gods. What we imagine is you shall have no pagan or no foreigner's ideas. But in fact, is it highlighting that we so easily become attached to, and as you said, Merv, make gods of our own understanding of God?
And if you decide that the Eucharist is the only place you can encounter God, you're a heretic.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Merv, you silenced everyone with that comment. Now we do.
Yes.
There's nothing like burning a few heretics just to fire up the conversation.
Look, I think I'm going to add in this because I want to pick that up, and I think this is especially important for the Catholic community because we do it is right that for us the Eucharist is central source and summit, as we know. We're not doubting that, but it's the problem is our perception of what the Eucharist is, our understanding of what the Eucharist is, reduces it to the people who say the second best way to pray after the Eucharist is adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, which of course it's not. The Church doesn't teach that. Like if that works for you, great. But if looking up through the trees or climbing in the forest works, am I a heretic there, Merv, or have I gone too far?
Well, I'll put a step in before going out into the forest. Eucharist is to be consumed. It is food. It is given to us. We receive it. We take it in. And we are meant to become Christ's. Eucharistic adoration is lovely and good, but it is a stage in a process. And it's slightly liturgically weird because it detaches the presence from where the presence is meant to be going.
And also, again, I think that it's true what you say, John, that we can reduce the presence to the Eucharist, and we forget that it's just a sign of communion. What Jesus was doing was what he did all his life, being in contact, being with the marginalized, inviting to meals to the marginalized, the vulnerable, the suffering, creating really a community of people. And that is the importance of the Eucharist. So I think we reduce it when we think that it is just the presence in the moment of the Eucharist. When the presence is when we as a community, when we as a group of people try to really protect the vulnerable, protect the ones who are suffering, be kind to each other, respect each other, that we are living that presence, as Tracy was saying. We see the presence of God in the other person. So it's, as you say, the communion, the Eucharist has to then become community, because if not, it's nothing, it's empty. It's just a sign without the content, which is creating communion between us as people.
Back in my catechist days, I used to teach little children, you know, about the Mass. And I used to tell them, and I believe this is true, that when we gather for Mass, Christ is present in the people gathered. It's present in the word spoken. It's present in the Eucharist. It isn't just present in the Eucharist. So it is that community, as you were saying, Rossi, you know, that community gathered in the scripture spoken as well as in the Eucharist. And it seems reductive to me, like as you were saying, Merv, just to have one thing and almost idolatry.
Can I go out on a limb here a little bit? Because let's call it incarnational theology, because we are speaking in a particular time and place and context, and people are listening in a particular time and place and context. And my sense is that generationally this understanding shifts a lot. Like, I am very interested in enormous numbers of young people who move in terms of Eucharistic theology to what might have been popular in the 1950s in New Zealand. Whereas when perhaps you and I were going through seminary, move, what we were learning was perhaps more towards the what we're saying here, the communal dimension. So there's a bit of a, is it an oscillation or the pendulum swing, or is it inevitable that we keep on doing this throughout history? Or, to use a line that many of these younger people, giving enormous amounts of time through day and night to adoration of the Blessed Sacrament, they would say, well, we're right and you're wrong, which is, of course, in itself a misunderstanding of the unity Eucharist calls us to. But what can we comment about that? I'm very aware, too, that right in this week, a relic of Carlo Acutis has arrived in New Zealand. Now, I'm finding it very difficult to get interested at all. Like, to record Eucharistic miracles is a great thing to do online, and to retain appropriate faith to a 15-year-old through suffering and dying of leukemia is wonderful and clearly a sign of the presence of God. But when it becomes, we want to understand Eucharist just like Carlo Acutis seems to, I wonder what your comment on that is. And if I've gone too far in raising it, I'll just delete this section.
Well, I'm going to be heretical now. And I...
Tracy, if you are heretical now, it will make me look good. So
okay, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and literally a limb, because when I was in Spain and Portugal a couple of years ago, I took lots of photos of reliquaries and like these hands like that had the bone exposed in them, because, you know, in one instance it was a relic of the 8,000 virgins, and, you know, and so on. And I have to wonder about, yes, I see God when I look up into the trees, and some people might say that's heretical, but I have to wonder about magic associated with an object. Like, you know, when it becomes, when the energy of God or the spirit of God becomes attached to an object, is that idolatry? Like, you know, we hesitate to, you know, kind of affirm the magic of Harry Potter, but we're quite happy to attribute like a miracle or magic to a reliquary or an object. And I find that really problematic.
And just linguistically, hocus pocus is a corruption of hoc est corpus. So when with that sacramental mystery that we talk about of consecrating the host, it has become the word used to describe magic. And magic is when you get the right words and do the right things, you will compel some other power to produce an effect.
That's a great move. Can we say magic is when something seems to happen, but it doesn't really happen? Miracle is when something really happens, but it might be hard to see.
Oh.
Now everyone's silent again. Is it?
I think that's semantics. My kids would have called it mumbo jumbo.
Mm-hmm.
and well, in that regard, I am a Latin American, so we like objects. So that's why, and we are very magical in our thoughts. So I cannot explain. For me, also touching the object. So it's a balance, I think, no? It's a balance to do. Because for us, for example, those, if my actually here beside my bed, I have a little lamb that belonged to my mom, and my mom has passed away, but she gave it to me. So when I touch it, I really feel my mom. So you could say it's magic, but it's not, because also the object brings with it something that you love. Of course, if the object becomes an idol, it's problematic. But also I think we are an embodied person. We need objects to touch. We need, of course, if we reduce our faith to those relics, I think is problematic. But at the same time, I think that we need touching. You know, we Latin Americans in our faith, we need a lot of touching, of embodied objects that help us to remind who we love.
And I reckon that's a Catholic intuition, that our faith is not just head and ideas. It's not faith alone, contrary to Luther. Catholics want to touch the holy. They want to go to holy places. They want holy people. They want holy things. They want to sign themselves with holy water. They want to make the holy gestures with their bodies. So this is back to John's incarnational faith. Religion is about doing, not just about thinking. And I actually reckon it's one of the insights of feminist theology, which is that you've got to get out of your heads some of the time.
But is there a line between like where we have, like, I fully understand, you know, the objects. I have my own little set of objects and stones and different things, and I understand the embodiment, you know, that's really important to me too. But when do we cross this line about, I want to use the word orthopraxy, you know, right practice, right doing, and cross that line between, you know, wanting to touch the object and idolatry. So I think that there is, there's a line here, like, and it's sometimes very difficult to see. And I think that what we're seeing in a lot of our churches in Australia and probably New Zealand too are a generation that don't have the same kind of stigma attached to, you know, say the Latin Mass and you know, some of the objects and the things that we experienced in our youth that maybe have negative connotations to them. And they're just so, enamored with this kind of, you know, embodiment of their religion, you know, the ceremony of the Latin Mass, you know, the bells and the smells, so to speak. And I don't think that we should discount that, because But then I don't think we should discount that, but we should also shouldn't discount the people who are looking up in the to the trees. You know, no experience, I think, should be prioritised over the other.
That's great, Tracy, because what you're doing there is you're broadening. You're taking what Merv said about Catholics are very, you know, it's about what we can see, touch, taste, hear. It's a very sensible faith. Can I ask you, Merv, or anyone else, to link that to sacramental theology? Because the sacraments all use very physical things. Like the sacraments don't have, you can't celebrate a sacrament online. There has to be a presence, touching, oil, water.
Well, I think this is very, very well connected with the symbolic and sacramental of faith and theology. So it is always, and I think that helps us to the apophatic way. It is not the sign never is exhaustive. It's always pointing to another reality that is mysterious. And I think, Tracy, that that's an important thing to not to lose, that sometimes we adore the object or the sign, but we must not forget that actually is the presence of a mystery, that is an invisible reality that we cannot possess, that it is, that we cannot control. And I think sometimes what we want is to control God, to control the sacred, and to possess. No, we have that, and I think theology
to contain,
always,
to contain, put
to
it
contain.
In a, put it in a box, and or in a relic, and carry that around with us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If Rocio landed up worshipping the light beside her bed, and feeling that that gave her comfort, and that object was the love that she experienced, that would be idolatry. When she uses it as a symbol of her mother and the fact that her mother gifted it to her, and in a sense she goes through that object to the love of the real person, that's sacramental.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you touch a statue, and it is interesting, idol worship and devotion cannot be distinguished from outside behaviors, because they look the same, but it is the intention of the person that makes the difference. This got argued out in theology in the 7th century with the iconoclast controversy.
I find the reliquary thing really tricky. I see that it's it can be a passage to the divine or a conduit to the divine, but it always seems to cross a line for me. And that's, I guess, me personally. I find it difficulty that it is only through that object, or particularly through that object, that that the miracle happens.
Look, I'm very aware that we are near our allotted time, and I want to, maybe we could each conclude with imagining or keeping in mind any people who might be listening to this, wanting some encouragement for their own faith. Maybe people who perhaps grew up with quite a part in an attachment to even religion, but feel as though they've grown and they're actually engaging in the work of theology, and they'll be encouraged by many things that you've said here, I'm sure. But if you were to give an encouragement for those who are listening to take away in terms of their own understanding of God, doing of theology, whatever, what might you say, just as a concluding comment in a sentence or two?
I would like to say, to finalize, that also theology is not just about God. Theology is actually also thinking about human beings, about the world, about creation, because actually with the light of God, with the light of faith, because sometimes we think that theology just occupies about talking about God, but actually And that's why theology is so broad, and we can do all types of theology regarding different topics, because it's okay how we see reality with the light of faith. And that's why we can, and that's why the Pope can write about AI, because okay, and he can do theology regarding AI, because he's looking at the things of the world with the eyes of theology and God and faith. So I think it's a quite lovely adventure. Anything that you can think with the light of the faith, you are thinking about God.
St. Anselm's line, faith seeking understanding. When you think about your idea of God, when you think about what you believe, you're doing theology.
I guess I'd like to leave people with a bit of a challenge, and I'd like to say, if your place of thinking about God or seek your faith seeking understanding is only in a church, like during Mass, go outside and sit in nature for a while, look at the trees, look at the sunset, walk barefoot in the grass. If you haven't been to Mass in a while and your faith seeking understanding is only outside a church, you know, pop in and look at the reliquary, you know, take a moment to reflect in what the Eucharist might mean for you. So I guess I'm challenging people to take their faith and seek understanding outside where they might normally.
Wonderful. Thank you all. I'm inspired, excited by this conversation, because it's been encouraging for me, but I'm also thinking, as we're chatting, about many people who have said to me, you know, I need to know more. This will encourage them not to go to libraries as much as to reflect on their own experience, to notice what's around, to be sensible, we could say, in terms of living, use their senses to allow the divine to speak. So thank you to you, Rocio, Tracy and Merv, for agreeing to be part of this conversation. And there may be more. If you would like more, then just let us know in the comment section below, or we'll send me an email and we'll see what we can do. But most of all, share this with others, share this conversation, this podcast with others, and then go and have your own conversations. Imagine that you're recording your own podcast and do theology. Is that a good way to conclude?
Yeah, absolutely.
Great.
Well, it's in the mail.
Yeah, I think.